From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the history of Islamic fundamentalism by focusing on the life of one of its founders, Sayyid Qutb, an Egyptian who was executed in 1966 because the Egyptian government believed he was part of a network of terrorist cells plotting to assassinate President Nasser. Our guest will be religion scholar Karen Armstrong. She writes about Qutb in her book, The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. She's also the author of Islam, A Short History, and the bestseller, A History of God. Islamic fundamentalism, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. More than 30 workers on Capitol Hill have tested positive for exposure to anthrax spores. The findings come after a letter containing the deadly bacteria was opened in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office on Monday. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Most of those exposed to the spores work in Daschle's office, although staffers from Wisconsin Senator Russell Feingold have tested positive, along with members of the Capitol Police Department. The Senate plans to stay in session until Friday, while the House has dismissed lawmakers until next week.
So we'll use the time we have available to us just to ensure that we have checked the entire complex of office space so that we can open on Monday without fear of any further exposure.
Officials say the only anthrax spores found in the Capitol complex so far were in Daschle's office and the Senate mailroom that handled the letter. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Defense officials said today special operations forces are standing by aboard the U.S. aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk in the Indian Ocean. The Pentagon says the troops are prepared to launch search and destroy missions in Afghanistan. U.S. warplanes have struck targets across Afghanistan for 11 straight days, and there have been indications that preparations for using Army or Air Force Special Operations Forces are moving ahead, but officials today offered no details on the mission of the troops aboard the Kitty Hawk. Pentagon officials say the U.S. military is changing its approach to airstrikes in Afghanistan. U.S. commanders there are now establishing what they call engagement zones, where pilots can be directed to bomb a variety of targets. From the Pentagon, NPR's Tom Gelden reports.
For the first 10 days of the air campaign in Afghanistan, U.S. commanders were intent on hitting the Taliban military's anti-aircraft artillery and surface-to-air missile sites. As long as the Taliban had a viable air defense, U.S. pilots were at risk of being shot down. But Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam of the Pentagon Joint Staff says those air defenses are mostly gone now, so U.S. commanders can divide Afghanistan into engagement zones where air crews will be given a variety of targets to hit.
We now have the access to be able to do engagement zones that we might not have had with an air defense capability that we've recently taken out. We have set the conditions where we now can utilize this doctrinal tactic.
The choice of targets to hit in these engagement zones will be made by air controllers who are themselves aboard some of the aircraft flying over the country. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
A radical Palestinian faction is claiming responsibility today for the assassination of an Israeli cabinet member. The U.S. is pressuring Yasser Arafat to go after those responsible. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres reportedly will meet with Secretary of State Colin Powell in Washington next week. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 151 points. The Nasdaq was down 75. The S&P 500 down 20. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that recent terrorist attacks in India prove the world's terrorism problems extend well beyond Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network. Speaking at a news conference after talks with Indian officials, Powell condemned a car bombing earlier this month that killed nearly 40 people in Indian-held Kashmir. Powell came to South Asia in hopes of easing tensions between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, but fell short of his goal as hostilities appear to be increasing. The Bush administration today announced that it will not use adjusted census numbers for distributing more than $185 billion in federal aid. Some state and local officials say the decision will hurt urban areas and minorities. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The decision on whether to use adjusted numbers had been eagerly awaited because many localities say their populations were undercounted in the 2000 census. But Acting Census Director William Barron says a review of the numbers found that adjusting them using the results of a follow-up survey would not make them more accurate. He says the census undercount appears to be far smaller than previously thought, in part because many individuals were counted twice. Barron acknowledges that the estimated undercount for blacks and other minorities is still greater than for whites, and he says more study is required. Many cities had hoped the adjusted numbers would be used, making them eligible for more federal aid. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush is on his way to China. He's going to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting held in Shanghai. Mr. Bush says he's planning to win more support for the war on terrorism as well. The four-day overseas trip is the first for the president since the September 11th attacks. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to take a look at the history of the extremist edge of Islamic fundamentalism by focusing on one of its originators, Sayyid Qutb. He was recently described in the New York Times as the intellectual grandfather to Osama bin Laden and his fellow terrorists. Qutb was an Egyptian who was born in 1906 and was executed in 1966 because the government believed he was part of a network of terrorist cells which was plotting to assassinate President Nasser. Qutb disseminated his political and religious ideology in a best-selling book. My guest Karen Armstrong is a scholar of the religions of the world. Her books include Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. She lives in London and is currently a visiting scholar at Harvard. You describe Sayyid Qutb as the founder of Sunni fundamentalism. You say almost all radical Islamists have relied on the ideology that he developed. Now, he studied Western literature as a young man. He was a literary critic. What radicalized him?
A number of things. At first, he was really passionately interested and involved in Western culture, Western literature, and indeed in secular politics. Qutb was not a sort of foaming-at-the-mouth fundamentalist. He was not even particularly involved in religious politics at all, though he always loved the Quran. He'd learnt the Quran by heart at the age of 10, when he was 10 years old. And he always said that the Quran was the lodestar of his life. But gradually he began to become disenchanted with the West. First, there was the colonial activity of European powers like Britain and France in North Africa and in the Middle East. He began to be sickened by the way that the European powers were invading the Muslim countries and taking them over and rather humiliating the Muslim people there. He disliked, too, the support that was being given to the state of Israel by the colonial powers, by the United States, because he'd got anything much at that point, anything much against Judaism, but because it was going to mean that Palestinians would lose their homes. Really crucial was a visit that he made to the United States.
This was in 1948. He was here from 1948 to 1950.
That's right. And he had a sort of study period here. And he was really rather disgusted by a lot of Western culture. He found it very sort of materialistic and pragmatic. There seemed to be no sort of spiritual element in American public discourse. And he looked around at all these bars and nightclubs and casinos. There were immodestly dressed women there. There were lewd films, pornographic films, in his view, being shown. And he just sort of felt that this was a trivial society, that it didn't seem to have the richness and depth that he'd associated with Western society when he was studying literature. But still, that was not what turned Qutb into a radical. His first targets were not Western targets at all, but Muslim governments, so-called Muslim governments.
He joined the Muslim Brotherhood in 1953. What was the Muslim Brotherhood at the time he joined it?
The Muslim Brotherhood, at the time that he joined it, was predominantly a welfare organization. It was a reform movement which was trying to bring the fruits of modern society to the population, to the vast bulk of the population. The Muslim Brothers, for example, provided clinics for the people. They provided a lot of schools and colleges. They founded businesses and factories to give Muslims jobs, but with better working hours, better insurance, better facilities for prayer, for example, than that was provided by the secular government. You have to understand that the process of modernization in the developing Muslim countries, especially those which have been colonized or occupied in some way by British Western powers, has been a very difficult one. It tended to split society down the middle. There would be a small elite who would have a Western education, who would understand how such institutions as democracy and parliament worked. They understood the process of secularization. But most of the population of Egypt, a very poor country, didn't have this advantage. And they saw their country being changed, their cities being changed in ways that made the whole thing unrecognizable to them and rather frightening. The Muslim Brothers were predominantly concerned to bring the fruits of modernity to the people and begin to educate them in the new Western ethos, but keeping their Islamic faith going alongside it, because that provided some very important and healing continuity.
The Muslim Brotherhood became a much more radical and much more anti-Western organization. How did that happen?
Well, I think we've got to be clear that it was only a tiny proportion of the Muslim Brotherhood which turned to terror. But there was a lot of radicalism in the air. Most of the political parties had developed a kind of extreme terror wing. And the Muslim Brotherhood, which was a huge, massive organization, vast, and it too developed its radical wing. Now, the problem was that the Brotherhood was far too powerful for President Nasser. He was promoting a secularist government, and the Brotherhood had a huge appeal. It was the only Muslim party that was able to appeal to all sectors of the population, to the very poor, to the professional classes, as well as to the rich, because of its Muslim emphasis. Islam was something that everybody could understand and appreciate. Egypt was a very religious country. And Nasser's secularism and socialism didn't have those grassroots with the bulk of the people. And so Nasser was determined to crush the Brotherhood, and they gave him a perfect opportunity. They handed him the opportunity on a plate when one of these extremists in the Brotherhood attempted to assassinate the president in 1956. And then Nasser could move and eliminate the Brotherhood. And he did so in a way that was absolutely decisive for radicalizing Sayyid Qutb.
Well, Sayyid Qutb was arrested in, I think, 1954, 2 years before the assassination attempt on Nasser.
Nasser was continually rounding up members of the Brotherhood. Now, Sayyid Qutb had gone into the camp as a moderate. He was he was still by no means a radical person. He was a reformer. He wanted to perhaps reform Egyptian society along Islamic lines, but certainly wasn't envisaging any kind of radical extreme fundamentalist activity. But in the camp, he had he recoiled in horror from what was happening to his own country.
What are some of the ways in which he was radicalized while he was in prison?
Well, in prison, he looked around. He saw that about 1,000 of the brothers had been executed by the regime. He saw young men being subjected, as I say, to mental and physical torture. And he said this has all the marks of what he called the Jahiliyyah. Now, the Jahiliyyah is a term used by Muslims to describe the society in Arabia before the coming of Islam. The term really means the age of ignorance, Jahiliyyah. It was the Prophet Muhammad, when he brought Islam to the Arab people, replaced the pagan establishment of Mecca with his own Muslim rule. Now, the Jahiliyyah was a term that everybody just used to apply to this period of pre-Islamic Arabia. It has overtones of a sort of ignorant barbarism. But nobody before Sayyid Qutb had dreamt of applying the term Jahiliyyah to people who were professing Muslims. That is what Qutb did. He said this government of President Nasser is Jahili. It is part of the Jahiliyyah. Even though Nasser said he was a Muslim, even though Nasser in his speeches, would use Islamic terminology when it suited him, he said, nevertheless, this government bears all the marks of this ignorant barbarism. It's Jahili, and we must fight this, just as the Prophet Muhammad fought the Jahiliyyah of his own day.
By saying this, he basically opened the door or helped open the door to overthrowing Muslim governments.
He was giving a green light to say that it was a Muslim duty to fight against your own governments. Now, it's very important to recognize that fundamentalism in all faiths, whether it's Jewish, Christian or Muslim, nearly always begins with an internal dispute. Fundamentalists begin by attacking or denouncing their own fellow countrymen, their own co-religionists. It's only at a later stage that some of them then turn to a foreign foe, to an outsider. And so Qutb here was in the line of mainstream fundamentalism in saying now it is a duty for us to overthrow this disgusting regime, which is cruel. It's tyrannical. It is persecuting Muslims. Here we all are in jail. And at this time, too, the late 1950s, 1960s, Nasser was getting very belligerent about being extremely secular and was determined to push religion into a subordinate position. And he was making it his avowed intention to replace any allegiance to church and really separate what we would call church and state. And again, this seemed part of this whole barbarous way it means of fighting religion.
You say that jihad was a central part of Qutb's vision. How did he define jihad?
Well, for Qutb, jihad was holy war. He based his whole ideology on the life of the Prophet, and he said that in the life of the Prophet, God had revealed a divine program, and this was the only way to bring your society into line with God's laws. And one of the important things that the Prophet did was stage four, the fourth and final stage of this divine program, was a holy war against Mecca, against the Jahiliyyah, the pagan, corrupt, barbarous society of Mecca. And so for Qutb, jihad really had come to mean holy war. and which it does not do. Jihad traditionally has had a much vaguer, wider range of connotations in the Muslim world.
And so how did he define it?
For Qutb, instead of seeing jihad as a struggle, an effort that Muslims must undertake on all fronts, moral, social, political, educational, intellectual, spiritual, he saw it simply in terms of fighting a war. First, Muslims must dedicate themselves and create a vanguard of committed individuals, a special party dedicated to the overthrow of the Jahiliyyah, the government such as Nasser's. Second, they must retreat from that society and create special enclaves of pure faith where they will bond together and prepare themselves for the coming struggle. And then finally, they will fight a dedicated war on all fronts. Now, Qutb didn't give specific guidelines about how this war could be fought because he saw this program taking place over a very, very long period of time. There must be an intense preparation, and it must be a religious preparation, a spiritual preparation, as well as just gathering a few arms and guns. But he was utterly convinced that this jihad, this struggle, this war would be successful because God had said that this was the way to go.
My guest is Karen Armstrong. Her books include Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We've been trying to talk to scholars, historians, journalists, and religious leaders to help us understand the terrorism that we're confronting. We're going to take a short break here to ask you to support public radio so that the news, interviews, analysis, and commentary you rely on will continue to be here for you at this time when we need good information more than ever. My guest is Karen Armstrong. She's a scholar of monotheistic religions. Her books include Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, which is a history of fundamentalism in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. We've been talking about Sayyid Qutb, who you say was basically the founder of Sunni Islamic fundamentalism. Let's talk about one of his influences, Abu'l-Ala Maududi, who lived from 1903 to 1979. He was a Pakistani journalist and politician who was published in Egypt. What were his main beliefs?
Maududi was also very upset about the West, about Western influence in countries such as India, what was going to become India and Pakistan. He had no enthusiasm for the idea of a sort of separate, secularized Pakistani state. But what he wanted to see was a dedicated struggle against the encroachment of the West. The West was seen very much as a colonial divisive force. I mean, the West was in India, had been in India since the 18th century, since the British invaded there. And he felt that Muslims had encountered hostile societies before, and they had done so, Maududi said, by relying on Islam. And they must now oppose the secularist ethic of the West by an increased, renewed appreciation of their religious roots. But what Maududi did, which was quite new, was put jihad, the idea of a military, militant struggle, a holy war, right in the centre of his system. Because of the present emergency with the Western powers, until the crisis was over, jihad was the main duty of the day.
And another thing he said that probably influenced Qutb, you say that Maududi feared that Islam was about to be destroyed. He saw democracy as usurping the power of God. And he argued that an Islamic state should be totalitarian because it subjects everything to the rule of God.
Yes. And again, because you have to understand democracy didn't have quite the same positive ring for somebody born in British-controlled India. He had a much more totalitarian view, but because it would all, everything must be under the rulership of God. Yes, I mean, this was a coercive theology, but not, and even though he had a strong influence on Qutb, Maududi and was the forerunner to Sayyid Qutb, he never hit the same popular note. And I think he lacked the popular touch of Qutb because Qutb brought the Prophet Muhammad into this.
And was Maududi published? Were his ideas disseminated?
Oh, yes, but Maududi was a well-known writer, journalist, and lecturer, indeed. And his books were indeed widely disseminated. And people were beginning to think along these lines. There had been, up until about the 1920s, a real enthusiasm for Western culture in the Muslim world. But by the 1930s, 40s, this enthusiasm was beginning to sour as they saw Britain and France and setting up protectorates and new kind of colonies and treating the subject population in a rather dismissive manner, not allowing them to take their destiny into their own hands. Maududi felt that this was a great crisis, that Islam was in danger. Every single fundamentalist movement that I've studied in Judaism, Christianity is in Islam, is convinced that modern secular society is the enemy of religion and wants to wipe it out. So they feel that they're fighting, Maududi certainly felt, was that Muslims were fighting with their backs to the wall against a hideously powerful force. And that they must exert all their efforts to counter this great threat to religion.
Maududi was Pakistani. Was he ever imprisoned for his beliefs?
No, and he did sort of go over to Pakistan and get involved with the new government there. That even though this was not the kind of Islamic State that he had envisaged at all, He was responsible very much for forming the kind of Pakistani revolts that we're seeing right now against America. The Jama'a, the party, the vanguard, really, which we are responsible for a lot of these anti-American demonstrations. A lot of the demonstrations we're seeing now against the war in Afghanistan have been deeply influenced by Maududi's ideology.
Karen Armstrong is the author of A History of God and Islam, A Short History. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Islamic fundamentalism's latest extreme phase. We continue our discussion with religion scholar Karen Armstrong, author of Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Sky of Stone, the sequel to the memoir October Sky by Homer Hickam. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her books include the bestseller A History of God, Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism. We're talking about the history of Islamic fundamentalism by focusing on the life of one of its ideological fathers, Sayyid Qutb of Egypt. Let's get back to Sayyid Qutb, who you say founded Sunni Islamic fundamentalism. He was executed in 1966 under the regime of Nasser. Was this part of a larger execution of Muslim extremists?
No. Nasser stepped in and said he wanted Qutb executed. Personally, this was a special initiative of Nasser's. The following year, 1967, saw a major change in the region, however. Qutb died just too soon to see this. The Six-Day War in Israel really changed the whole region, and on both sides of the conflict, on the Israeli side as well as on the Arab side, there was a religious revival, and this was just the kind of atmosphere in which the ideology of Qutb could take strong root.
Nasser's Egypt was defeated by Israel in the Six-Day War in June of 1967. How did that defeat further radicalize the extremist fringe of Islam in Egypt?
Well, it radicalized everybody because it was a dreadful, devastating defeat. It seemed to discredit all the nationalist, socialist kind of ideologies that people such as Nasser had been espousing. These ideologies, people thought, had just made Egyptians or Arabs weak. They'd been completely flattened by this dreadfully humiliating defeat. And so people began to turn back to Islam. They said, let's go back to our roots. Let's throw out all these foreign imported ideologies, which have never done us much good. Most of the people have never understood them anyway. Let's go back to our roots, to Islam, to what it was like, what our culture was before the advent of the West in our countries. And this much the same process started to happen in Israel after their devastating experience in the 1973 October War. And there was a religious fundamentalist revival in Israel too.
Nasser, when he was the president of Egypt, clamped down on Islamic fundamentalist groups. Many people in those groups were put into prison. Many were executed. After Nasser, when Sadat became the president of Egypt, what was his approach to the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, Sadat realized that he had quite a job on his hands to be as popular as Nasser. And he decided to strike a more religious note. So he let all the Muslim brothers out of jail. And they came back into society, many of them radicalized by Qutb's ideas. And so there were a lot of extreme young men around. Sadat also encouraged the new groups that were developing in the universities, young groups of students who were organizing and regrouping and as part of this huge religious revival in the Middle East after the Six-Day War. And he gave them a great deal of encouragement. And it was a young man who had been in one of these groups, student groups, who was responsible for Sadat's assassination. This passes an important message to us. It's very dangerous to ignore fundamentalist movements and to think they don't matter and they'll just go away. We've just had horrible
evidence to see what happens when we do that. But it's also very dangerous to try to exploit them or use them for our own ends. This is what happened to Sadat. He'd courted these groups and then they turned almost into a Frankensteinian monster that killed him.
Let's look at how Qutb's philosophy is being used today. Now, Osama bin Laden is not Egyptian. He grew up in Saudi Arabia, and he was born into the Wahhabi sect of Islam. But his number two, or the person who is believed to be his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, he is Egyptian. I'm wondering if listening to the statements by bin Laden or by the spokesperson of bin Laden's group, if you've been hearing any resonance with Qutbi and his writings.
I hear resonance to Sayyid Qutb all the time in bin Laden's statements in his texts. He talks about a vanguard. He talks about these hijackers as God has created a vanguard. That's Qutb's ideology. He's been saying the world is now divided into two camps, one for God, one against God. This is exactly Qutb's ideology. He's talking about a jihad very, very strongly in Qutbian terms. And he's also absolutely convinced, like Qutb, that this is God's plan, not just a human plan, God's plan. And it's bound to be successful. So I hear resonances all the time. It may not. These movements, of course, have their own life. They all sort of develop and expand and change under the influence of events. But certainly the stamp of Qutb is on this.
Do you think that bin Laden and al-Qaeda have taken Islamic fundamentalism to a new extreme with the terrorist attacks that we believe they're responsible for, and even in the kind of rhetoric that they're using?
All fundamentalism in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is becoming more extreme right now. And we're almost getting what I would call post-fundamentalist groups, people who believe they're going beyond the fundamentalism that erupted so strongly during the 1970s into a new, more desperate phase. And I think something like this is happening here. I've been very puzzled by the behaviour of the hijackers. I think we know that Mohammed Atta the Egyptian who drove the first plane into the World Trade Center, was drinking vodka before he got onto the plane. Now, that is an extraordinary act. I cannot think of a single... alcohol, of course, is forbidden in Islamic law. No Muslim fundamentalist that I've been acquainted with or studied would ever dream of going to Allah in paradise with vodka on his breath. Some of the fundamentalists were the one who was driving the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania was well known to frequent the nightclubs in Hamburg and had even non-Muslim girlfriends. Now, no fundamentalist that I know of would go anywhere near a nightclub. Nightclubs are part of the jahiliya. They're part of the corrupt society that Qutb recoiled from in such horror when he witnessed them in the United States. It's almost as like a sort of nihilism here, as though fundamentalism is moving into what we call an antinomian phase.
What does that mean?
It means that you ignore all law. And sort of trample on all values. If you are killing and massacring thousands of innocent people, you've lost all sense of law. And in various moments of history, when people are feeling extremely desperate, this religious extremism, and there are various examples of this in the past, can tip over into a complete nihilism where all law, even your sacred religious law, is something that you trample on in your desire to get to a new phase. I'm not saying that this is happening, just to register a puzzlement that the behaviour of these hijackers was nothing like the people whom we classically define as Muslim fundamentalists, who live very orthodox lives, disciplined lives of prayer. I would never dream of drinking alcohol or going anywhere near a nightclub.
This observation I'm about to make is probably no more than very cheap psychoanalysis. But it has struck me that is it possible that someone like Muhammad Atta is at war with himself. You know, that he has all these impulses to drink, to have sex, and he's fighting these impulses. He blames the West for it. And because he sees these impulses in himself, he's just so upset and outraged by it that he wants to kill the West, to kill that impulse in himself.
Yes, I think I don't think that's a cheap psychobabble at all. I think it, I think it's an acute observation. To commit an act like that, you must be doing extraordinary violence to, you know, even your basic instinct of self-preservation. And history is full of examples of the way when we're unhappy with ourselves, when we feel torn with among ourselves, when we don't know whether we're religious or secular, or as many people in the Islamic countries who do feel split and that they belong in neither East nor West. This kind of conflict is very often projected onto the other. Christians did this way back at the time of the Crusades, when we were fighting a brutal holy war in the Middle East against Muslims, something which in no way could be justified by the peaceful gospel of Jesus Christ. We were, in a sense, at war with our Christian selves, but we then said it's Islam that is the violent, intolerant faith, and we must fight it to the death, and that it's the enemy. So it was a projection going on there. And similarly, much of the classical Western phobia about Jews was similarly based on worry, buried anxiety about Christian behaviour, Christian beliefs. And I think you're quite right, there's something of that sort going on here, that people, especially in developing countries, were torn, as I say, between East and West, tend to project all that hatred onto an enemy that they can define and feel and categorize as absolutely evil and therefore out of the cast of any form of human consideration.
My guest is Karen Armstrong. Her books include Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is religion scholar Karen Armstrong, author of Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God. We're talking about the history of Islamic fundamentalism. I want to read you something that Andrew Sullivan recently wrote in the New York Times Magazine and get your reaction to it. He wrote, "Most interpreters of the Quran find no arguments in it for the murder of innocents, but it would be naive to ignore in Islam a deep threat of intolerance toward unbelievers, especially if those unbelievers are believed to be a threat to the Islamic world. There are many passages in the Quran urging mercy toward others, tolerance, respect for life, and so on, but there are also passages as violent as this, quote, 'And when the sacred months are past, kill those who join other gods with God, wherever ye shall find them, and seize them, besiege them, and lay wait for them with every kind of ambush. And this, believers, wage war against such of the infidels as are your neighbors, and let them find you rigorous.'" Your reaction?
My reaction is, yes, the parts of the Quran were revealed when Muhammad and his Muslim community were fighting a deadly all-out war. They were facing the prospect of extermination, and so they were fighting for their lives. And but what these texts, people who quote these texts, very often neglect the words that immediately follow in almost every case. which says, but if the unbelievers are not attacking you, you are forbidden by God to attack them. Allah is merciful. Peace is always better. Now, this is a very complicated question, and I think we've got to sort of really unwrap this. We've been hearing a lot of these texts bandied around, but we've got to bear in mind that in our own scriptures, we have very Christian-Jewish scriptures, we have some very ferocious passages. But because we know so much more about Judaism and Christianity, we don't assume, take these passages out and say that therefore there is an essential incitement to violence in Judaism or Christianity. In the Torah, the most sacred part of the Jewish scriptures, there, God commands the people of Israel to drive the Canaanites out of the promised land, to destroy all their religious symbols and to make no treaty with them. Now, a tiny proportion of Jewish fundamentalists use these texts to justify harrying the Palestinian people in the present conflict. But nobody would say that these texts are typical of Judaism. Similarly, Jesus in one passage says, do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have come not to bring peace, but the sword. I have come to set whole family members against one another and to set up real conflict. Now, no one quoted this text at the time when Christian Serbs massacred 8,000 Muslims in Srebrenica. You know, we mustn't put Islam, because of our ignorance of Islam, just draw out these isolated texts and assume that they are typical of the whole of the Quranic scripture, the bulk of which is all about mercy, justice, compassion, courtesy, kindness, politeness. And that's the overwhelming impression of the Quran, not these isolated passages, which even in the actual verses that were quoted there by Andrew Sullivan are immediately succeeded by exhortations to peace, mercy, and to make peace where as soon as the enemy sues for peace, says the Quran, you must make peace with them and agree to any terms. So this was revolutionary in 7th century Arabia.
Do you feel like we're living through a religious war where, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the leaders of the United States and I think most of the people of the United States don't see themselves as making war against Muslims, but rather against mm-hmm. terrorists. But the Islamic terrorists who are creating war against the United States and other parts of the West do seem to see this as a religious war in which everyone in the United States is a target.
Yes, but don't let's forget the backlash we've seen in countries like America and the United Kingdom, where people have been attacking mosques and Muslim women who are wearing the hijab on the streets. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, all Muslims are bad in our own countries, though not, I'm glad to say, among our governments. And I've been really impressed and grateful that President Bush, like Tony Blair, has been saying we are not fighting a war against Islam. This is something new. This carefulness, this to distinguish between terrorism and Islam, this is a new and hopeful development on the part of our leaders, and I'm delighted to see it. Do I feel that we are? Yes, I do. I don't see it as a war of Islam against Christianity or a clash of cultures. This is a far more a struggle within societies, where sectors of Muslim society are at war with one another, just as in the United States. This is the case. Not in the United Kingdom, however, but where there is no interest in religion, where nobody is seeing this as a religious war, where people have been ringing me up in London and saying this shows that religion should all be stopped and by force of law, you know, it's just awful and evil. So in the United States, which is a very religious society. Now, lots more Americans are going to church, I believe, than they did before September the 11th. So there's a heightened religiosity in the country, but we've got to make sure it's good religion. Not all religion's good. It can be really bad, awful immoral religion, like the religion of the hijackers. And if any Christian feels that it's a holy thing to attack a mosque or a woman wearing the hijab, then this is rotten religion.
Religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her books include Islam, A Short History, and The Battle for God, A History of Fundamentalism. She's currently a visiting scholar at Harvard. This is Fresh Air. In this war against terrorism, we each need to be armed with good information and a knowledge of history to help us comprehend and respond to what is happening. And that's where public radio comes in. So we're going to ask you to make a pledge to support your station. Rand Blake is one of the most subtle of jazz pianists, influenced by low-key singers like Chris Connor and Gene Lee, as well as by blues and gospel piano and orchestral harmony. Sometimes in his music, Blake tries to capture the dark psychological and emotional shadings of Hollywood film noir, stories of quiet men who may find themselves cornered by circumstance. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Blake's new album is a bit like that. Here's Rand Blake on David Raskin's noir theme for the film Laura.
Rand Blake is one of the most introspective of jazz musicians, a master of nuanced touch and shaping notes with foot pedals. He has a knack for making old chord changes and blues licks sound rarefied and mysterious all over again. He really pushes contrast between light and dark or loud and soft passages. But he can get so absorbed in details, he may lose track of time. Other pianists use a bassist and drummer to keep their tempos true. Blake rarely does. His new album, Sonic Temples, is his first with a conventional rhythm section in 15 years. Rand Blake on Sarah Vaughan's hit Black Coffee, laced with a little Heartbreak Hotel. Adding bass and drums can create problems for Blake as well as solve them, since a rhythm section adds more than just rhythm. A bass player hems in a pianist's left hand, as two players down below tend to muddy the bottom. And even a light splash of cymbals can interfere with delicate high notes. Beyond that, This bassist and drummer seek to engage Blake in conversation, or at least make him speak up. They don't just roll out a carpet for him. That assertive approach works sometimes, but it can also backfire with an introvert like Blake. His laid-back stylings can sound more reticent than ever and make him recede into the background. There's an extra musical subtext that may shed light on Rand Blake's low profile here. His 2-CD Sonic Temples was conceived by his old friend and champion Gunther Schuller, who produced it for his GM label. Schuller picked the tunes from among his own favorites and chose the rhythm section, his sons Ed on bass and George on drums. Now, those are two fine and sensitive players who grew up with Blake's music and sound very good together. But when you factor in tunes by and dedications to various Schullers, and guest shots by a Schuller in-law on alto saxophone, Blake's in the awkward position of guest of honor at someone else's family reunion. But that predicament suits him somehow. Fascinated by psychological complexity, Rand Blake illuminates problems that may arise on either side when you try to draw a shy person out.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Sonic Temples by Rand Blake on the GM label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from Loudon Wainwright's new CD. He'll perform on our show later this week. This song is called I'm Not Gonna Cry.
I'm not gonna cry today, I won't shed a tear. Even if some milk is spilt, I won't dilute my beer. I won't use a tissue, my pillow will stay dry. And I won't need a shoulder, cause I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna snivel and I'm not gonna sob. Both my eyes will remain dry and I won't have to daub them. Move me with a tragedy, just go ahead and try. Play me a tearjerker, but I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna weep today, I will not wet my cheek. I'll count to 10 and I'll hold it in, I'm not gonna leak. I'm not gonna lose it, though I may wanna die. They say it's good to let it out, but I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna blub today, and I'm not gonna bawl. And I'm not gonna fall apart, even if you call me. I couldn't cry for 40 years, I was too tough a guy. Now I can do it anytime.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the war against terrorism with Michael Gordon, the New York Times military affairs correspondent. He's also the paper's former Moscow bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.